Good morning. On today's programme, the wildfires raging through the Australian state of Tasmania and how French wine producers are struggling to cope with Trump's tariffs, climate change and the fall-off in consumption among younger drinkers. But first we go to Tunisia. The European Commission is to fundamentally overhaul its payments to Tunisia in the wake of damning revelations of human rights abuses of migrants by EU-funded security forces. A new report has found what it calls state trafficking of black migrants by the Tunisian National Guard to Libyan militia who extort ransoms or sell migrants into labour or the sex trade. Outgoing EU Ombudsman Emily O'Reilly has strongly criticised the European Commission over its lack of transparency regarding their human rights monitoring in Tunisia. Elysia Voltman has this report from Tunis.
I answered a group WhatsApp call and I heard a woman sobbing uncontrollably. In the background, I heard the cries of other women and children, and then the line was cut. The crying woman's husband, a Sierra Leonean migrant, who I will call John, stayed on the line and said, "Everyone is crying now." John's wife had been arrested 2 weeks prior by Tunisian security services, along with four other women, three of whom are pregnant, and three children. Following the arrest, John's wife and the others were taken to Ben Gherdan, the last town before Tunisia's border with Libya. After that, he didn't hear from her for 10 days. John said that his wife was being held captive in the town of Yefrin in western Libya by local militia. In their first phone call since leaving Tunisia, she was forced by her captor to demand 3,500 Libyan dinars ransom money per person. That's nearly 700 euros. It's not a huge amount, but for a migrant, it's a fortune. John currently lives in one of the informal migrant camps in the olive groves north of the Tunisian port city of Sfax that is the main hub of Tunisia's people smuggling industry. Like the thousands of other migrants living there, John came to Tunisia hoping to get a smuggler's boat to cross to Italy. But now he finds himself blocked, with no way to catch a boat, and without access to NGOs like the International Organization for Migration, he has no way to return home. He also has no job or possibility to earn money except from begging. He has no idea how he will raise the ransom money and fears the worst for his wife and family. John's wife's story is similar to the stories recounted in a recently published report that alleges that Tunisian National Guard have been selling sub-Saharan migrants across the border to Libyan state and non-state militia for ransom and exploitation. The report was authored by a group of civil society organisations and academic researchers based in Europe. They accused the Tunisian state of the crime of state trafficking. The report's launch was held in the European Parliament, supported by left-leaning MEPs who have been pushing back against the European Commission's funding of North African countries as part of the EU's efforts to keep migrant boats from landing on European shores. They say that the European Commission is acting in an executive way, taking no account of the European Parliament and are ignoring their own reports that have exposed gross human rights abuses by the Tunisian state authorities. Tunisia's Minister of Foreign Affairs refuted these accusations of state trafficking on their Facebook page, claiming they were part of a continued spread of malicious allegations and the circulation of false and misleading news. Members of the European Parliament are not the only voice criticising the European Union for turning a blind eye to human rights abuses by the Tunisian authorities. Emily O'Reilly, the outgoing EU Ombudsman, has strongly criticised the European Commission for its lack of transparency regarding their human rights monitoring in Tunisia. Following O'Reilly's report, the Commission claims that it will overhaul the funding of Tunisia and the so-called migration deal. The EU has struck similar deals with countries including Egypt, Mauritania and set to increase funding into Morocco, casting doubt on their sincerity to apply pressure to third countries to respect human rights. However, although the European Commission appears to be taking on board some criticism, efforts to bring human traffickers to justice are proving difficult. Recently, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for a notorious Libyan war criminal and human trafficker Osama al-Masri Najim, but his arrest was allegedly scuppered by Italian authorities and he was released free to return to Libya. The spotlight then turned on Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni by Italy's investigative magistrates, with suspicions that she and Italy's Justice Minister were behind the judicial appeal that saw al-Masri released from detention. It's reported that Libyans were in uproar over the arrest warrant, and that it was Libya's Prime Minister in Tripoli, Abdelhamid Dbeibeh, who asked Meloni to return the militia leader. European countries, including Italy, Germany, and now the UK, have given donations of money and equipment independently of the European Commission on grounds of migration control. So even if the EU cuts its funding for migration management, its richer member states are only too happy to give money to North African countries to hold back migrants. The UK Foreign Secretary David Lammy made a one-day whistle-stop tour of Tunisia, where he met President Kais Saied himself before meeting other ministers, including the Minister of Interior. He then travelled to the coast to meet officers from the Tunisian National Guard Maritime to discuss migration management and to give them a present of night sights and drones, which he says will help rescue migrants in distress at sea. The video of Mr. Lammy's trip showing him flying drones looking out to sea with special night vision binoculars has mostly been met with laughter and snorts of derision by Tunisians. They are not impressed by a donation of a mere £5 million from the sixth richest nation on earth, and they say that this will have little impact on job and wealth creation in their cash-strapped nation. But it's migrants who have expressed deep distress seeing the UK Foreign Secretary giving tools and money to enable the Tunisian Coast Guard to better search for migrant boats at sea. They say they feel trapped in Tunisia, unable to move forward with their lives, unable to leave or to settle there and create a life and a future for their children. And they say Tunisia is not safe for black people. For World Report, I'm Alicia Falkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
Next, we go to Australia. It's been another exhausting week for firefighters in the state of Tasmania. They've battled blazes on the island's west coast. In recent weeks, emergency crews in Victoria have fought very large fires in national parks west of Melbourne. Fire is an integral part of the Australian story, and while destructive blazes are frequent in rural areas, they have also now invaded the suburbs. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia is one of the most fire-prone places on Earth. Experts say the winter disaster in Los Angeles is a brutal reminder of the dangers facing cities here. Greg Mullins, a former commissioner of fire and rescue in the state of New South Wales, said it was absolutely chilling to watch what had taken place in California. It could very much happen here in Australia, he warned. The outskirts of cities like Sydney, Perth, Melbourne, Hobart and Adelaide are all very, very fire-prone. Last September, Amanda Nicol was playing at home with her young children in Cromer on Sydney's northern beaches, an elevated residential district a short drive from the Pacific Ocean. She was alerted to the danger by a yellow haze from the smoke of a fire in woods nearby. Fanned by coastal winds, the flames in Cromer spread quickly. Amanda has described helicopters flying closely overhead. You're confronted by a lot of panic and stress about whether or not your house could possibly burn down, she said. The family managed to leave safely, but the fires in suburban Los Angeles have been a reminder of the vulnerabilities of living in an area surrounded so closely by bushland, and where there's just a single road in and out. The fires in LA were exacerbated by a severe drought that was preceded by years of heavy rain, fueling the growth of vegetation, which was dried out by hot, dry winds. Similar conditions happen here, but Australia so far has avoided a conflagration on that scale. Researchers say it has come close, most notably with the Canberra fires in 2003 and the Black Saturday disaster in the state of Victoria 6 years later. Resilient building design and construction could be key factors. Houses in Australia tend not to be as tightly packed in as they are in other cities. In January 2003, Canberra, the nation's bush capital, had the worst wildfires in its history. Four people died and more than 500 properties were destroyed. Liz Tilley was trapped by the flames in her home with relatives in the Canberra suburb of Duffy. She didn't know if they would escape. Confronting such a fire, she said, was an overwhelming experience. The noise and the sound of explosions, she said, were like nothing you've heard before. It was like jet planes bearing down on you. Liz did manage to finally leave her home. It was rebuilt, and the family moved back in, and they've been there ever since. A royal commission acknowledged that global warming had helped to drive the Black Summer fires in Australia 5 years ago that raised an area of land the size of the United Kingdom. Australia's cities are increasingly pushing into the bush. Greg Mullin said such development is a worldwide phenomena and that homes needed to be more fire resistant. Community groups should be given basic firefighting equipment to allow them to be frontline defenders. Crucially, planning rules need to be reassessed. You don't build homes on floodplains, so we're going to have to do the same with fires in the future. There are places where people shouldn't live, he said. Australia is well used to nature's extremes, but scientists are warning that the intensity and frequency of fires, storms and droughts are increasing. In many ways, this is a country on the front line of climate change. For World Report, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Finally, we go to France. The European Union announced this week that it would propose a package of support measures for the continent's struggling wine industry in the coming months. The sector, which has been hit hard by climate change, inflation, and sharp falls in consumption, is also facing the threat of US tariffs. The crisis is perhaps being felt more keenly in France, the world's largest wine producer, where people, particularly the young, are drinking much less than previous generations did. Sharon Gaffney reports from Paris.
A shadow loomed large as hundreds of French wine producers set up their stalls in Paris this week for one of the industry's biggest trade fairs. Still traumatised by the impact of the 25% tariffs imposed on French wine during Donald Trump's first presidency, the sector is bracing for a fresh wave of levies from the White House. The biggest export market for French wine, sales to the US plummeted by almost a third under the tariffs as American consumers sought cheaper alternatives, including Italian reds and Australian whites. But with or without new taxes, the industry is facing huge challenges, hit hard by higher production costs, inflation, and a trade spat with Beijing. French wine and spirit exports fell for a second consecutive year in 2024, with imports to China down by a fifth year on year. But it's the domestic market that's of most concern to winemakers. Long considered an intrinsic part of the country's national cultural heritage, the French are drinking far less wine. Consumption has fallen dramatically in recent decades, a far cry from the mid-19th century when people were downing, on average, a bottle of wine each per day. Until the 1950s, children as young as 8 were allowed or even encouraged to drink wine in school canteens. Lunchtime boozing wasn't banned entirely until 1981, and it wasn't just students cutting back. In the 80s, more than half the population said they drank wine every day. Now, fewer than 8% of people say it's part of their daily ritual. As a result, sales are falling significantly, by nearly 2% annually. Restaurants report that customers are much more likely to order wine by the glass rather than the bottle. In some supermarkets, beer purchases are 5 times higher than those of wine. The trend is particularly prominent among younger people, more than a third of whom say they never drink wine unless they're in the company of older relatives or having dinner with their families. Preferring environmentally or social media friendly brands, they're buying beer or cocktails or abstaining entirely. Wine for the younger generation is increasingly considered elitist, pretentious and old-fashioned. Most unfashionable of all is red wine, sales of which have fallen by a third since 2011. While not yet prompting an existential threat to producers in Bordeaux, where 85% of wines are red, more than one in three vineyards in the region say they're struggling to stay afloat. With production far outstripping demand, some are switching their focus to white, sparkling, rosé or organic wines to diversify their output. Climate change is also taking its toll, transforming the defining flavours of grapes and producing wines with a higher alcohol content, or even spoiling entire vintages. As well as warmer temperatures, harvests elsewhere are contending with spring frosts, drought, heavy rains, parasites and disease. The changing environmental conditions underscoring the urgent need for strategies to help producers adapt their practices. To that end, the government has allocated more than €50 million to fund the removal of thousands of hectares of vines. A further €200 million is being set aside to cover the destruction of surplus wine, with the alcohol in some cases sold on to companies for use in products like hand sanitizer or perfume. The crisis facing the sector is not unique to France. Adverse climate conditions have pushed global production to near record lows. After approving emergency assistance for the industry last summer and forecasting further sharp declines in production and consumption, the EU announced this week that it would be proposing a series of fresh support measures for the industry in the coming months. For World Report in Paris, this is Sharon Gaffney.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.